Good morning. Why don't you come on in? We got to have a great conversation here. We've been looking over the data, and I've got some very smart people who are going to break it down for us. So come on in. We'll get started in a minute. Okay, let's get started. Very excited to be with you this morning, talk about last night and the coming days and maybe weeks. I'm Larry Jacobs. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota in the Humphrey School of Public Affairs. This is part of an ongoing series of conversations that we've been having about the election all year long. They've covered a whole range of topics, from Black Lives Matter and the Latino and woman vote to looking at working class votes. We've looked at campaign strategy, looked at policy issues. So this feels like a kind of a culmination. What happened and why? And I want to let you know that we are eager for you to join us. It's part of our tradition that we look for questions that are challenging. You may disagree, you may want other topics. Please help us get to that. At the bottom of the screen, you'll see there's a Q&A button, and just click in there and give us your questions, and we're gonna get to as many as possible. So I wanna thank our guests this morning, Justin Bowen, who's a Democratic strategist, and Vin Weber, who's been associated with the Humphrey School for more than two decades, former member of Congress in the Republican Party in the Southwest corner. And he is now at the Mercury firm in Washington, D.C. Both Justin and Vin provide an extraordinary access to both the national and Minnesota thinking within the Democratic and Republican parties, and they have access to data that we don't. So it's great to have them here. Thank you very much, Justin and Vin.
Thank you, Larry.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Did you get some sleep last night or not?
I got very, very little. So so I may be off my game or be sipping my coffee throughout the morning presentation.
Okay, so we're going to give you some hard math problems later.
I'll leave those to Vin.
Okay, Vin, what happened last night? We were kind of all built up for this knock 'em out fight. What happened?
Not a good outcome. And I don't mean in a partisan sense, we can get to that. But what we'd all hoped for, I think, was after all of this polarization and turmoil of the last year and years, that we would have a decisive win, a decisive victory, and think that the election would give what elections are supposed to give, which is some clarity. It did not. The news media and the pollsters were broadly advertising a big Republican defeat. That didn't happen. It was a close election. We're sitting here, you know, I expect, by the way, that Biden will be able to claim victory by the end of today, but that won't even end it because there'll be court challenges all over the place, particularly in Pennsylvania and probably in Nevada. So it was a closer election than anybody thought, anybody expected, and it's not going to go away for a while. We're going to be fighting this out in recounts and court battles, and finger pointing at the news media and the pollsters for a long time, I'm afraid.
Justin, was this completely unexpected?
Well, I mean, I think that the how close some of these states were absolutely unexpected. If you're looking at the public polling, I think the Biden team would have told you that they thought the race in Pennsylvania and in Wisconsin was a lot closer than some of the polling had said. So it wasn't necessarily, a surprise for them. You know, if it turns out that the Vice President Biden holds Nevada, wins Michigan, where he's ahead, wins Wisconsin, where he's ahead, and either comes really close or pulls off Georgia, then from a purely, you know, electoral college map, that looks kind of in line with what we were thinking, with, you know, a couple of other places being close that were within the margin of error, North Carolina, for example, that the Republicans are going to pull off. But, you know, absolutely, the polls in Wisconsin had us up, 8 to 10 points in some, even more in others. Big wins in Michigan. It kind of looks like Minnesota is the one place that that pollsters and prognosticators kind of were about right.
Right.
Okay, I'm hearing bipartisan agreement that it was the pollsters' fault for raising expectations. And I want to get into that in a minute. But first, I want to rerun what I thought was the narrative going into the election. The Democrats had stormed the early voting, meaning that they had cast disproportionate numbers of mail-in ballots, absentee ballots, and that the expectation is that when those ballots were counted, it would show the Democrats ahead. On the other hand, the Republicans had been steered away from early voting by the president repeatedly, and that we would see on election day a surge of Republican support. And so, you know, what's surprising about Pennsylvania? The president's up 700,000 votes. There's almost 1.5 million votes that were cast by mail that are going to be counted. They are being counted. And initially, it looks as if somewhere around 7 to 8 out of 10 of those ballots are going to be going to the Democrats. Isn't that what we expected, Finn?
Yeah, it's pretty much what we expected. I think the Republican surge on election day met or exceeded expectations in a lot of places, but the Democrat, you know, margins among the mail-in voters was at least what they expected. And yeah, it's going about the way we thought it was going to go, although by a narrower margin in most of these states than we thought. Maybe if we'd gone back, you know, a couple of years or so and sort of projected forward, we could have said this is what we thought it was going to look like. Very close elections in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. But that's not what people thought the last month or two or since the summer. They thought it was going to be a blowout in those states for the Democrats. And it wasn't. I believe they'll win at certainly Michigan and Wisconsin. We'll see about Pennsylvania. It'll be razor thin either way. But it was supposed to be not a close election in those places.
It was not supposed to be a close election. Instead, we ended up with a 2016 finish.
Yeah. And it's, you can get discouraged by all of this, but as I said, you'd hope that the election would have established some clarity to where we are politically in the country and given people some greater confidence in the system, even if their side didn't win. I don't think that happened. I think that the disenchantment and disillusionment of the American people with our political system, which I lament, is not going to go away for a while.
Vin, just 1 second, Justin. Vin, when you look at a popular vote that's going to show a Joe Biden win of 4 or 5 and possibly 6 points, does that look like a kind of a popular mandate that the president's leadership has been rejected by, you know, 5 to 10 million people? It looks different to me than 2016. It looks like a statement about, the sentiment about the president's leadership.
Well, certainly if I were the president, that's what I'd argue. But, you know, we've had that argument now for about 4 years. People are kind of used to it. And unless we're going to challenge the existence of the Electoral College and the United States Senate, it kind of doesn't matter. But it's a good arguing point for Biden. We should talk about this. The only certainty, it seems to me, for the next 4 years is divided government. And if Biden is the president, that strengthens his hand a little bit in trying to get things done in the Congress, but not immeasurably. The geographic distribution of the vote means the Democrats are still, vote-wise, are very concentrated on the two coasts.
I'm sorry, Justin, you were about to jump in.
Well, I was gonna piggyback off on your comment about kind of the Republican turnout and the early vote for Democrats. And, you know, I don't know, Vin has been doing this for a long time as well, in fall campaigns. It was the weirdest election day I've ever experienced, where there's basically nobody in the places that we're watching going to the polls and voting. They had already cast their votes. Lines in places like Farmington and in parts of the 7th congressional district, where Democrats usually don't see lines, and I kind of felt like we were twiddling our thumbs. It was very smooth in the boiler room, the war room, for the Biden campaign in Minnesota. But so it was a very different experience. And I think there's going to be more of this moving forward. Democrats are going to continue to push for early vote even after the pandemic is done, you know, trying to bank votes as much as possible, and then hold on as we head into election day, I think.
But Justin, let me ask you, if we end up with Joe Biden having, you know, maybe 296 electoral college votes or somewhere in that neighborhood, he has a 10 to 20 million vote margin, isn't that a fairly decisive win, or do you agree that it's pretty muddled because of the way we're going to get there?
Well, I think that the president started the muddling last night by trying to declare victory and saying that they should stop counting votes. And that was a political argument to try to delegitimize Biden. I think it also was a acknowledgement by his team that they weren't going to pull this thing off, because at the time, at least, you know, according to the votes that had been counted, he looked like he was in good position. So I think that narrative is going to continue out there. And so that will probably muddle the mandate. I also agree with Vin, we're going to probably almost certainly have a Republican controlled Senate. Now it may be close. We'll see how close it gets, depending on what happens with the runoff or runoffs in Georgia. I would think Republicans are probably favored in January. They usually do better in special elections than Democrats, but we're going to have divided government, and the races were a lot closer than we'd expected. But, you know, I'll come back to the original thing I said. If we end up winning Michigan, Wisconsin, and hold Nevada and Arizona, then, you know, we flipped three Republican presidential states. The White House went through the Midwest and the blue wall, as I think many of us predicted 2 years ago and kind of continue to talk about. I think Democrats got intrigued by the idea that we could pick up a Texas, a Florida, Georgia, but it was kind of back to, as you said, back to the 2016 map, kind of all over again.
Then we are looking at, as you said, a number of lawsuits. Now, to file a lawsuit, you need a case, or it's case and controversies is the term of art. What is the case for legally counting ballots? I mean, there's no doubt that, as far as I can tell, in legal terms, there are ballots in Wisconsin that have to be counted. There are ballots in Michigan that have to be counted. There is some discrepancy around, you know, when to count so-called late arriving ballots in Pennsylvania. But we do know that the Secretary of State says there's 1.4 million uncounted legally cast ballots. Is that a legal issue? Just count the ballots that meet the rules?
I don't know exactly what the legal case is going to be, but I can guarantee you they're going to find one. Not that they're going to win it, but they're going to find one. And I think, when you have elections are complicated matters of necessity, and you're always able to find something that looks irregular and make a case for that. As I said, I don't assume that you win that case, but I think that there's going to be arguments that ballots were not properly submitted, that local elected officials didn't properly count them or didn't properly screen them, if you will. And, we saw that. And if you go back to the Florida example in 2000, you know, we argued about every vote. And it's in the end, it was a very close election. And But I think that that's what we have to look forward to. I don't know exactly what case is going to be brought, but I think they're going to scrutinize. And if it's not decisive, and it looks like it can't be decisive, although, as I said, I expect Biden will be able to claim victory, certainly by the end of today. If it's not a decisive win, they're going to find all sorts of ways to challenge it.
Justin, what do you see the legal case that concerns you the most as you kind of assess the day after?
I mean, I think yes, they're going to file lawsuits, absolutely, because they're hopeful that they can change the result. But I see these legal challenges almost as a political argument. They need to try to muddy the water on the election results. They need to show the Republican base that they're fighting for every vote. There's lots of Republicans that think that in Trump's base that feel like that this was an unfair election. And I think that he's been sowing those seeds for a long time. And so I think that the legal challenges are not going to be successful legally, but the goal is a political one as much as a legal one.
And that's true. But it's even deeper than that, I think, on the Republican side, Justin, because the Republicans, particularly the strong Trump supporters, believe that the Democrats spent the last 4 years trying to delegitimize his entire presidency through the impeachment process and other things. And they're going to try to delegitimize the Biden presidency. And at a legal constitutional level, that's not going to work. But in terms of the confidence of the country in our institutions, it may work.
I agree with that, absolutely. I think that is absolutely what the plan is, or the play is here.
Vin, if you were in the Trump campaign, would you have advised the president to make the statement he made last night?
No. I would advise the president to look as presidential as he can. And he's capable of that. I mean, he's capable of showing discipline when he thinks it's important. But he needs to look like the president now and try to legitimize these challenges that we've talked about that go forward, and not give more credence to Justin's apt observation that this is all political. Yeah, I think it is all political, but you don't want the country to believe that you're doing it only politically. So he needs to act presidentially during this process if he's going to have any chance at all of prevailing.
And do you, Justin made the argument that the court case have to go forward as just a political matter and a base maintenance matter. But when you kind of look at how the court's likely to respond to this, we saw challenges in Texas. We have seen challenges that the state, federal, and the Supreme Court have weighed in and pushed aside. Do you think there's kind of actionable material here to stop a recount in Pennsylvania, where there are, 1.4 million ballots that have not been counted?
No, not I don't. You can get. I'm not a legal authority, so I'm a little hesitant to predict too much, but I don't think that there's going to be really actionable items that'll actually stop the recount. To the extent that I can interpret it, what the courts have sort of said so far is they are going to respect the state's right to conduct the elections. And maybe that'll be unlimited, but that seems to be the guidance that came out of the Supreme Court. And I think that will likely be the guidance that will prevail in most places. But, we got a lot of judges and some of them have different attitudes toward these things. But it seems to me that the principle that states conduct the elections is going to be given a lot of credence as we go through this unfortunate process.
I want to go to the exit polls, which we had. And I think one of the most interesting issues is why did last night happen? And yes, the Electoral College, is going to be a complicated issue, but we did have, perhaps 70 or more million folks vote for Joe Biden. Why did that happen? And the president came in 10, 15 million fewer. One of the questions asked voters to rank five issues. And the number one issue, Vin, was the economy. 35% said the economy was a number one issue. If you had told me that before the election, I might have thought that the president would have done pretty well, particularly given the good news of late and the sense that, yeah, there's a recovery going on. Things are not where they were in January.
Well, yeah, I think he should have done well on that issue. But I do think that Biden, at the end of the day, the Democrats were able to conflate that issue a bit with the other major issue, which was the epidemic or the pandemic. And the argument that that Biden made, which is you can't see the economic recovery unless you crush the virus, persuaded a lot of people, not everybody, but a lot of people. And I think that took away from the president the kind of advantage you would think that he might have given the good economic news of just the last few days, the 33% increase in GDP last quarter. Those things should be very strong talking points for an incumbent president. But the pandemic was effectively utilized by the Biden folks as a counter to that issue to a substantial extent.
Justin, we've got these issues here, but then we've got judgments about the president. And both moderates and independents broke decidedly for Joe Biden. Was that based on the issues or character?
I think probably both, and it probably had a lot to do with President Trump as well. I mean, when you're running for re-election, it's often about the view of the incumbent party candidate, and so I think that obviously was to Biden's advantage. Back to your other question about the economy for the president, I think that the Biden campaign effectively tied the economy to the coronavirus, as has been pointed out. And also, I think the president did himself a disservice down the home stretch, not talking enough about the economy. He got weighed down into blaming healthcare professionals for COVID numbers and spent a day and a half talking about that and gave the Biden team something, a very strong talking point. And so I think that he hurt himself on the economy as well in the final 48 hours.
Then one of the things that comes out in the exit polls is that the suburbs, which used to be friendly to Republicans, are now basically parity between the parties. Do you think that's a long-term thing, or is that just a Trump thing?
It's undetermined, Larry. I think it's certainly in the short term, it's a Trump thing. It's not terribly surprising, but we'll see how a Biden presidency, I mean, the suburbs reacted against a president that they didn't like. It's not necessarily clear that the basic values of suburbanites, political values, economic values, are substantially different than they were 5 years ago or 10 years ago, maybe a little, but not a lot. And so, the reality for the Democrats is going to be that they no longer are going to have Trump to blame for everything. And as we know, the midterm elections usually go against the party that holds the White House. And that's an opportunity for Republicans to come back in some of these suburban areas. But there has been a shift in the country. The suburbs are no longer Republican strongholds. And there are very few rural areas where Democrats are even competitive anymore. So we've seen that change. The problem for Republicans is, we are increasingly an urban country. And, we have traded, suburban communities for rural strongholds that used to be Democratic and are not Democratic anymore. It's not an even trade.
Justin, I want to ask you about campaign strategy. And I'll admit that I was skeptical earlier this year when I was asking you about the Democratic Biden strategy of suspending their door-to-door work because of the coronavirus in favor of more digital and other sort of distance approaches. Mm-hmm. And yet I see in the exit polls, and so I'm gonna need a little bit of crow here, that among those who voted for the first time, they broke about 2-1 for Joe Biden. Do you think the distance approach that Biden used was effective?
Well, I think it sure looks like it. I mean, we're gonna see massive turnout from base Democrats in our base areas, Hennepin County here in Minnesota, the Detroit and Detroit suburbs. So I think we got big turnout. you know, I don't know how much of that was Biden campaign, how much that was Donald Trump, all of the above. You know, I think when we get past the coronavirus, we're going to go back to the way we've done campaigns with the door-to-door efforts, but we're going to be able to layer this new tool on the digital and on texting side, which I think was very effective. I think I got over the final 72 hours probably a half a dozen phone calls and text messages and emails about getting out to vote.
Hey, Vin, the Republicans ran uninterrupted door-to-door operation. In Florida, what they did in Dade County was almost textbook in running up, you know, doing very well. My sense is it may have flipped Florida from being a toss-up or maybe even a Biden state into going into the president's column. Do you think the Republican strategy this time around, in terms of how it campaigned, made this race closer than what the pollsters were expecting?
I think the Republicans, yes, I think they had the right strategy. I think a strong ground game is in their interests, and I think it helped the Republicans. I think it particularly helped them in Florida. Florida does not look like the swing state we've always thought it was. It doesn't look deep red, but it looks to me like a Republican state. And I think other states are swing states now. That Arizona seems to have flipped the other way. But let me say one other thing related to this, and you come back to your previous question, Larry. Excuse me. I think that Biden's strategy of basically laying low for a long time was helpful to him. To the extent that he got out, he looked friendly, approachable, presidential, non-threatening. And Trump was Trump. He would go around and scared people all over the place. However, Biden got much more aggressive in his campaigning the last 10 days. And I don't think it helped him. I know Biden a little bit, and I'd see him out there. Every time I saw him, he looked angry. And I don't think that served him well. In fact, I think in the final days of the campaign, he probably hurt himself a bit. Maybe it would have been a larger margin for him, but he didn't look like a friendly, non-threatening guy out there when he was in the attack on Trump. Now, you can say, well, look at Trump. Trump was attacking constantly. Yeah, sure. I'm not arguing that Biden did anything unfair. I'm just saying I don't think it helped him to sort of get out of this unfair comparison, but to get out of the basement and onto the attack. People didn't want to vote for a slasher against Trump. And he looked a little bit like that just the last week or so of the campaign, in my view.
Justin, I'm going to ask you about the timeline looking ahead in terms of the presidential election. According to federal law, the states need to resolve their vote counts and the disputes around them by December 8th. And then the electors in the Electoral College meet December 23rd. Do you have any concern about having 270 Electoral College votes in the Biden column by that point, those dates?
No, I mean, everything that I've heard from folks of the Biden team is that they don't. We talked about the lawsuits at the outset. I don't think that there's any legitimate lawsuits that they're going to win and that it's a political argument. So I don't foresee if we hold on to these states issues there.
Then I'm asking this question because there's so many scenarios. you go on the internet, there are many, many. I just want to see if we can save people a lot of time from searching for them. Do you think we're going to have resolution by the December 8th date that the states are supposed to have their vote tallies submitted?
Yes, I do. I think the road from here to December 8th is going to appear to be very rocky. A lot of screaming and shouting and hollering, a lot of filing of motions and things like that. But I think that we're going to resolve it. And I have a basic confidence in the court system that they will understand that it's necessary to come to closure on this and not disrupt that December 8th date that you talked about. That's a hope on my part. But I also think it's true. I think the judiciary understands that it plays a significant role here, and they will not want to be the determinants of this election.
There are lots of great questions here, I'm kind of bringing some in. But Justin, let me ask you one, which was, what happened with Latino support for Donald Trump last night? Was it a deciding factor in Florida that the warnings about Latinos not breaking for Biden sufficiently was the reason he lost?
Well, I think it, in different states, the vote went for Biden and Trump in different directions. One of the warning signals that I've been hearing from Biden campaign for some time was that we weren't doing as well with Latinx voters in Florida as the Secretary Clinton did. It clearly showed that we lost some margin there in the Cuban American, Venezuelan American community. Sounds like in Florida, some of the socialism attacks on Biden have worked or did work. Biden looks like he did better in some swing suburban places in Florida, but didn't drive up the margins in Miami-Dade County. Now, the contrast to that is the Mexican American community in Arizona went very heavily towards Joe Biden. And help put him over the top in Arizona. Looks like the same in Nevada. And so I think it kind of depends on the state and the messaging. And Republicans in Florida have done a very good job of reaching out to and building relationships with those communities there. The governor and the Florida Republican Party have invested heavily both time and resources into support there. And that made a big difference.
Okay. Vin, you were mentioning that the expected down ballot pressure of Donald Trump as a drag didn't play out. And I'm just curious, I noticed in Maine that only about 3/4 of the vote have been counted. Now, Susan Collins has a lead. It looks comfortable at this point, but is it possible that there are going to be some of these states like Maine, I think North Carolina is a harder one to imagine, where you're going to see the Democrat move forward as these mail-in ballots would tend to favor the Democrats are counted?
I don't think that's going to be a significant factor. I think the Republicans are going to control the Senate, probably with a loss of a couple seats, but still maintain control of the Senate. I think Maine is an interesting case. And I have to say, Susan Collins accomplished what most people couldn't accomplish, which was to successfully separate herself from the president enough to win in a state where the president was not popular without losing her own base, which did support the president. And a lot of candidates around the country would try to do that, but would not be effective at it. She proved that she is a really good politician. Those are good candidates. Those things matter. So she, but most places in the country, I don't think that's going to work. But I think that I just don't see where we're going to flip seats that the Republicans are counting on today that would flip to the Democratic side. I think it's going to be a Republican Senate. And I think the Republicans are going to gain about 10 seats in the House of Representatives, which also, by the way, defies some earlier predictions that said we're going to have the great blue wave and the Democrats are going to increase their margins in the House of Representatives. That didn't happen. Now we'll see what the final count is. We've got the number of seats in California that haven't been decided yet. But I think Republicans are going to gain about 10 seats in the House of Representatives. And if Biden is president, that matters a lot, because he's got to look then at a midterm election 2 years later, in which I would say it would be likely the House would go Republican.
Justin,
Divided government is going to be our reality for the next 4 years. And the fact that the Republicans and Democrats have not been able to work together on virtually anything for the last 4 years ought to cause all of us some concern.
Justin, what happened to the blue wave?
I think we're going to remain to be seen here. I mean, it looks to me like Democrats turned out in cities and suburbs. And we won those House races, and in the states where we had Senate races, that margin was enough to put us over the top. And Republicans picked up swing exurban and suburban districts in the U.S. House. So, I mean, I think Republicans outperformed in a lot of their areas from what pollsters and Democrats have predicted. And I also think the Democratic base turned out higher than a lot of folks had predicted as well. So, I mean, to Vin's point, it's a mixed result.
Yeah. But does it surprise you that Joe Biden would win decisively in Maine and then down ballot Susan Collins would appear to be hanging on?
Yeah, I mean, Susan Collins won her Senate seat last time by, I think, 30 points. So if she wins by 3 points or 5 points, you can see how that something like that could happen.
I'm just going to come back to my point. Susan Collins proved that she is a kind of unique character. I mean, most Republicans in that position could not have accomplished what she would have accomplished. They would have been swept away.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, look, how many Northeastern Republicans are left, Ben? I mean, like, yeah, Susan is remarkable in that sense, yeah.
I want to ask you, we've got a question here, Vin. As a Republican, the constant predicting that Trump would lose by a landslide sure felt like an effort by the media to suppress or discourage Republican turnout. You agree?
You know, I resist conspiracy theories, and I also resist media bashing, but I'm not going to dismiss that question. You look at the relentless negative media coverage of Trump for 4 years, but particularly the last few weeks, and the pollsters, we can get into that as well. I'm not going to allege conspiracy because I think it's hard to coordinate something like this and not have everybody know about it. But I do think the media deserves a lot of scrutiny for their coverage of this campaign, and the pollsters deserve, all the polling should be scrutinized as well, because it had an effect, and it looks to the average person like it was an orchestrated effort. Again, as I said, I don't believe in conspiracies. I think it's too hard to keep a secret, but I do think that the cumulative effect of the news media and not just the left-wing news media, the respected agents of the media, ABC, CBS, NBC, the New York Times, Washington Post. I read the New York Times and the Washington Post every day. They may as well put a disclaimer at the bottom, paid for by the Democratic National Committee. And I know these reporters and I respect them, but that's what it looks like to me.
Do you think Donald Trump almost incited that partly by his, you know, just constant lying and deceptions? And, you know, you can make an argument, but to bald-faced lie to a reporter who knows, you know, something about the matters, doesn't it kind of create an environment in which the media is on guard against that kind of a president?
Well, he created an adversarial relationship with the press. There's no question about that. And he vilified him in unfair ways, calling them the enemy of the people. Things, yeah, that's all unacceptable. And a very human reaction on the part of reporters and producers in the media to hostility to the president. Still, you know, you have professional obligations as a journalist, regardless of how contemptuous you are of the person you're covering. And I think that a lot of people in the journalistic world did not follow their journalistic responsibilities. I think that they went over the top, and I understand how they feel about the president, and I can understand why they feel that way about him. But that still is their job is not to be an advocate for the other side. And I think a lot of them went into that mode.
Justin, in the 19th century, there was something called the partisan press.
Right.
And each party tended to have its organs that would speak for it. And I don't necessarily buy into the idea of some of the press being the Democratic Party's organ. But when you look at Fox News or you look at and read some of the conservative radio shows, some of which I've been on, does that strike you as fair and balanced?
Well, I think that, you know, depending on the program on these stations, there are agendas, absolutely. And, you know, I come from a journalism family, and so I strongly believe that we need to have a fair and free press. And I think that they should be calling balls and strikes and not putting their fingers on the scale for one side or the other. I think that there is still a lot of that. And, question about how they should be reporting polling data and polling results. Maybe they should characterize them differently, that this is just a snapshot or this is just a prediction, and not make people think that it's a likely or guaranteed outcome. But some of that has to do with the way that media has changed as well. I mean, it's now there's an entertainment factor to media that the cable news shows play on, which is different than 20 years ago.
But just to give you a couple examples of maybe what Vin is referring to. The president struck a deal in the Middle East that's historic. It's a remarkable, it could be a game changer in the Middle East. So we're not thinking civil war and death and destruction. We think in the Middle East. As far as I could tell, there was about 6 hours of kind of appropriate positive coverage of it versus when Bill Clinton pulled off the peace agreement or Jimmy Carter, there were weeks of adulation. Or the economic news that came out a few days ago, it was, it felt like half a news cycle.
Well,
are those examples of a kind of a
bias? I don't know if those are examples of bias or of change, the way the media has changed in 20 years. I mean, the coverage on presidents paying $750 in taxes felt like it was around for one news cycle before we got to the next thing as well. So things are moving much quicker than they've ever moved before. And I think that goes back to my point about, there's a lot of entertainment in news as well. And folks want clicks and they want to keep viewers engaged.
One thing I just want to say, you will not like this, but we just have too much polling. I mean, I'm not suggesting we should regulate it or ban it or anything like that. But I'm saying, it used to be you'd wait for weeks between polls and you'd try to fit. Okay, the next one's coming out this coming Sunday. We'll see what's changed in the last month or so. You and I both. Now, we all get daily updates of all the new polls. It's just too much of it. And I'm not suggesting we should try to regulate it. I think the media should be a lot more careful about how much of this stuff they're reporting.
Well, everybody and anybody can call themselves a pollster.
That's the
thing. I mean, So
I want to just add a footnote here, which is I've done a lot of research on polling. I've done a lot of polling myself. But one of the projects I did with a colleague at Columbia, Bob Shapiro, is we went into the archives and we found evidence that Lou Harris had changed his numbers in response to pressure from the Nixon White House, particularly through Colson. And I think it's a pretty open and shut case. It won awards and so forth. And it got me a pretty hostile phone message from Lou Harris, which is all fun. But I think one of the responses to that by me and others is to say, let's not have just two pollsters. Let's have a group. And then why don't we average them? And then smarty pants like Nate Silver comes along and says, we're going to average them, but we're going to grade them in terms of how accurate they are. And, I'm not defending polling because I'm as frustrated as anyone.
You kind of are.
I'm putting it in the context, but I think polling did terrible. I mean, last night was just not a good run. We're going to do a program on this in a couple of weeks with some of the best pollsters, and I'm going to do my best to get them all angry. Hey, Justin, I want to ask you, with regards to the U.S. House, here's Biden winning, and then at least so far, and things will probably change, it looks as if the Republicans did pretty well in the U.S. House race and flipping seats and stopping the Democrats from flipping their targeted seats. What happened?
I think we had good Republican turnout in a number of places. I mean, I think we had some seats that would probably have been in Democratic hands longer than they should have that we ended up losing, like the 7th Congressional District here in Minnesota with Colin Peterson. And I think that in general, Republicans did some good work. Again, we don't know exactly the final numbers. A number of these seats are still out, and so we'll see how many they actually end up picking up at the end of the day. But the good news for Democrats is that Nancy Pelosi is going to continue to be the speaker. So,
one more thing, candidates do matter, and the Republicans recruited good candidates for the House this time. Michelle Fischbach is a good example. No disrespect to my friend Colin Peterson, but he had not run against somebody of that caliber in the past. Michelle's a former president of the state Senate, former lieutenant governor, a really good candidate. And that's, we have good candidates around the country. And again, the quality of the candidate does matter. And I think it enabled Republicans to win back some seats that the Democrats were sort of renting, if you will. And I think it'll be about a 10-seat gain for the Republicans. And, you know, the House is structured in such a way that Nancy will still be able to hold an iron grip over it. But it's a lot of her members are going to feel a little more pressed because they aren't going to be able to defect on any issue. Not, they won't have a big enough margin.
And Vin, you'll note that there was rumors going around that Tom Emmer was about to be axed as the head of the House Republican Reelection Committee. He looks pretty good today, huh?
I think he looks very good. I think Tom is a good candidate and a good chairman of the NRCC. He would, of course, like to have won the House, but if Biden is going to win the presidency, which I think we sort of think is all agree is likely to happen, he can argue strongly that to gain a significant number of seats in the House of Representatives while the party is losing the presidency is a pretty substantial accomplishment. I think he had a good night, and I think he's proved himself to be an effective leader.
Let me ask you, Justin, about campaign finance. We set another record. It's around $14 billion this cycle. What impact does that have? Did the fact that Democrats raised more money, kind of usher in Joe Biden? It didn't seem to have much impact on the U.S. Senate and U.S. House races.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only thing we're certain to have is more money raised and more money spent moving forward. I think these Georgia special elections or special elections are going to break all time records for spending. So money is the be all and end all in campaigns. It's messaging, it's ground game, and it's the candidates. So some of the places where we really drove up the fundraising advantages, like in South Carolina, where Jamie Harrison, I mean, I think it was always a long shot that we're going to beat Lindsey Graham there. The online money poured in against Graham, even though that probably wasn't the best use of money. Same with the McConnell seat.
Then
I'll bet you we will not see from President Biden a strong suggestion or proposal for campaign finance reform. The Democrats benefited from dark money this time.
Do you think it's time for that? Do you think there would be bipartisan support for putting back together McCain sort of framework?
Probably not. I think that the constitutional limitations on what you can do in terms of regulating campaign finance make it unlikely that they could achieve a bipartisan solution.
Vin, there's been a lot of talk about the Republican Party and the direction it's going, particularly from Democrats, or as you put it, the Democratic allied media. The New York Times editorial page ran an editorial with the headline RIP GOP. And it talks about it's time for the Republican Party as it's currently constituted to go away. And I see in the exit polls that the growing part of the electorate, which are the voters of color, made up 35% of the electorate, and it broke 72% for Joe Biden. What do you think of the future of the Republican Party? How would you characterize that?
Well, I think that the future of the party is not going to change in the way that the New York Times or other people would like to see it change. I think that the changes that Trump has brought to the Republican Party are there to stay for a long time. But it certainly is essential that Republicans figure out how to appeal to particularly the Latino community and hopefully the Black community, although that seems to be a much more difficult task for Republicans. But I don't write off the Latino community going forward. I think that they're a more fluid electorate. In terms of they may vote Democratic, but I don't think that the allegiance to the Democratic Party is anything like the allegiance that the African-American community has to the Democratic Party, which has been cultivated for generations. And Republicans can compete there. But, yes, I think Justin's right. The issue of socialism and things like that helped them, particularly in the Cuban-American community. But there's other issues where Republicans can appeal to Hispanic. The Hispanic community is very much a more conservative community than some other minority communities. And I think Republicans must compete for those votes. And I think that they will try to.
Then the Republican strategist, Brendan Steinhauser, was quoted in a Politico story. He said, referring to the Republican Party, he said, "We're almost in crisis mode. The party's base is very white. It's old, it's rural. And this is in a country that's becoming younger, more diverse, more urban. Everything is working against Republicans right now."
That's true for a while. And we'll see if it remains true. I don't want to get cynical about this, but there's no problem that the Republicans face that an unpopular President Biden couldn't solve for them. And I don't say that with any disrespect to Biden at all. I think he's a fine person. Maybe he'll be a hugely successful president, but I'm not so sure. You know, we thought the country was transforming itself in significant ways when Barack Obama was first elected, and 2 years later they lose the Congress. You know, I think that anti-incumbent dynamic is going to help the Republicans. And, you know, if you just take a snapshot of the party today, everything that guy said is probably true. I don't think it's locked in concrete by any means.
Justin, I want to ask you about.
Just want to add just a question on the GOP, taking it away from the national perspective and just looking at Minnesota for a second. So since 2006, the Minnesota Republican Party has won 1 out of 27 statewide races in the state of Minnesota. So Democrats 26, Republicans 1. So if you want to talk about, you know, maybe from a national perspective, it's not yet RIP for the GOP, but in Minnesota, that's absolutely the trend that we've seen.
So Justin, I want to ask you the flip side of that, which is we are seeing regional polarization. You're absolutely right that statewide races have fallen in the Democrats' favor almost every election over the last 15 years. But on the legislative side, here you had an election last night in which Joe Biden won by 7 points. And it looks as if the Republican majority in the Minnesota Senate will hold. There's races out there still being counted, so that's not for sure. And it looks as if the DFL majority in the House, which strategists hope would expand, actually shrank. And again, we don't know exactly by how much. What's going on in Minnesota that we're seeing Democrats doing well, as you said, but then Republicans doing well?
Well, first of all, I'd rather win the statewide races. That's the most important, right? Controlling the governorship in the U.S. Senate is a big deal. It sounds like kind of a status quo election as far as majorities in the state Senate. DFL picks up 2, Republicans pick up 2. We added in suburban districts. They've done better in greater Minnesota districts. Looks like we probably, DFL loses a couple of House seats, 3 of them in greater Minnesota for sure, and maybe a couple more in the suburbs. And so I think it speaks to the bigger divide that we're seeing between city and suburban voters and more rural voters and what that means. Now, it's also going to be interesting, you know, as we head into redistricting, if Minnesota loses a congressional seat, what the new lines look like and what these new Senate and House, Minnesota State House and State Senate districts look like and how that may shape the future of the legislature.
And are you concerned by this midterm backlash against the president's party with regards to Governor Waltz's reelection campaign in 2022? Is that a threat to him?
I think that one of the best things that down ballot Democrats are going to have going for him in 2022 is Tim Walz at the top of the ticket. I mean, what Walz has been able to do is reach out to those voters that don't always vote for Democrats. You know, his coalition is very similar to Amy Klobuchar's coalition. You know, he's going to do well in the first. He does well in northern Minnesota. And then, you know, we'll juice the margins in the metro again, I think.
I was talking to a Republican consultant last night who works on legislative races, and he was insistent that Governor Waltz's handling of the coronavirus was one of the factors that helped them in making the case for Republican legislative candidates here in Minnesota. Have you seen evidence of that?
That's the argument that they've been making. You know, they picked up a couple of seats, and so maybe there's a correlation there, or maybe it's just that Trump was able to turn out Republican voters that don't always vote in these legislative districts.
There's a real intensity in greater Minnesota against Governor Waltz. He's a gifted political leader, and Justin may be right in that he's going to be an asset to the Democrats in the midterm elections. But it's also clear if where I live in northern Minnesota or where I grew up in southwestern Minnesota, there's a definite feeling that the handling of the pandemic was not respectful of differences around the state. And I think that he's got a problem.
Question will be 2 years from now is how the pandemic and the coronavirus handling, if that's top of mind for voters and where we're at in that, obviously. And I'll just go back to, again, 26-1, I put my money on Tim Walz to win re-election.
And Justin, we've lost one of Minnesota's most senior member of Congress, Colin Peterson. What happened up there? Why did Colin lose? He's such a dominant figure in agriculture.
I think it's a real loss for Minnesota to lose the chairman of the Ag Committee. It was a district that was the most Trump district in the country that was held by a Democrat. I think that Colin ran a good campaign this time, but there are fewer ticket splitters than we've seen in previous elections, and that's what he ran into. And you know, Michelle Fischbach was a good candidate, and she, you know, she ran a strong campaign as well.
You know, looking through some of the close legislative races, you see the Minnesota Marijuana Party getting votes. Justin, is that a threat to DFL? They're ciphering away otherwise.
Absolutely. It looks like that a number of these close legislative races, the Marijuana Party got 5-7% of the vote. It sounds like from what the Star Tribune's reported that Republicans have been recruiting candidates in CD2, for example, against Angie Craig to run in those positions to try to siphon off some DFL vote. And it looks like it might've been successful in the two Senate pickups that they had. There were legalized marijuana candidates in both those tickets, both those ballots.
There is talk at the Capitol of possibly legalizing marijuana in order to generate revenue to handle the huge deficit we're facing. If that were to happen, do you think that would take the steam out of the Marijuana Party, or do you think it's around for a while?
Well, I think that it would take away their number one priority. So it would take some steam out of it. I mean, that wouldn't necessarily prevent, finding another third party entity to run in some of these districts, with the threshold being 5% for the major party status. It makes a big difference in Minnesota, unlike some other states.
We had, if I'm not mistaken, several states that legalized marijuana yesterday through referenda. It seems like that, and I think South Dakota was one of them.
Yeah,
which indicates, you know, that issue has not lost any appeal, and if they could win in South Dakota, it means that they can appeal in traditionally conservative areas.
Vin, I want to ask you about one of the exit polls here and see what you think of it. It shows that about 90% of Trump supporters and 90% of Biden supporters report that they are concerned or scared if their opponent is elected. Does that strike you as normal in American presidential elections?
No, it's not normal and it's not good, but it's true that people feel that way. People feel physically threatened as a result of the kind of rhetoric we've seen over the last few years. And I we have to tone that down somehow, but it's not going to be easy. And frankly, both parties, in my view, set up this election to be questioned if they lost. I mean, yes, the president, with his constant criticism of mail-in voting, suggestions of voter fraud, he convinced his base that if he lost, it would have been a stolen election. But the Democrats talked about voter suppression for the last 4 years, and if they lose, they will claim that that's why that's an illegitimate outcome. I don't know how we get past this, but we somehow have to get to the point where people accept the results of the election and look forward to the next one to remedy any grievances, and don't just carry on the election date for years on end.
Justin, does this worry you that we've got 9 out of 10 supporters of each of the candidates scared or concerned about the opponent winning?
Yeah, I agree. I agree 100% with Vin. It's not good, and I think it is the way people feel. I think that, you know, Donald Trump has thrown some gasoline on that fire over the last 4 years. I'm hopeful, and you know, this is what Joe Biden said when he was running, that he was going to be the president for all people, whether they voted for him or not. I think that you can bring down some of the rhetoric, the president can, by the way that they talk about things. And so if Biden comes out, I'm hopeful that some of that gets better. But, like, you know, this partisan divide is not going to change whether Joe Biden wins or Donald Trump wins. Again, we're a divided country. It's incredibly close across the board. And you know, we're a long way away from people feeling comfortable on both sides.
No, a Republican Senate could be a real blessing for a President Biden. If the Democrats had taken everything, the progressive left of the Democratic Party would have considered it an open invitation to achieve all of their goals, starting and end the filibuster, abolish the Electoral College, pack the Supreme Court. All of those things are going to be off the table because there's a Republican Senate. And it would allow Biden, if he wants to govern, as Justin pointed out, that he says he's going to govern, closer to the center and try to unite the country. He still has to cope with his own party. And I'll leave it to Justin to tell me how tolerant the left wing of the Democratic Party is going to be of a Biden who tries to work with Republicans and move to the center.
So one of the big winners last night was Mitch McConnell, who won decisively in his reelection bid. And he's going to be a key figure. Do you imagine that Mitch McConnell would take that attitude with regards to Joe Biden?
I think it's definitely possible. I mean, McConnell is one of the most effective legislative leaders that we've ever seen. He infuriates the opposition because he beats the opposition. But he wants to accomplish things. And if Biden wants to accomplish things, then McConnell is not going to want to just sit back and try to destroy the Biden presidency, in my opinion. I mean, he's a partisan. He's going to want to see a Republican elected in 4 years. But that doesn't mean he's going to get up every morning figuring how he can destroy Biden. If Biden will actually try to compromise on some things, there is an opening. It may be a small opening, but an opening to do some things.
I hope you're right, but I think a lot of us remember Mitch McConnell's comment when Barack Obama was first elected, which is,
yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, he said his job was to prevent his reelection. We have run out of time. This is another great hour with Justin Bowen, Vin Weber. Thank you so much. You two have been tremendously generous with your time and your knowledge all during this election cycle. I want to wish you a happy new year, but I also have a feeling we may be back together in the not too distant future.
Probably so.
Because this is going to be an ongoing struggle with the election, and then we're going to get into a fiery new year. So thank you both very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Larry.
Thanks for hosting us.
And I want to just say a quick word about upcoming events. Next week, we've got two extraordinary events on U.S. foreign policy. One is with Jake Sullivan, who is an advisor to Biden, was an advisor to Hillary Clinton. That's Monday coming up. That's at noon. And then we've got Richard Haass, who's the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, who will be with us on next week as well on Thursday. That'll also be at 12. And then later in the month, we're going to have Suzanne Mettler, professor at Cornell, talking about her new book on the four threats facing America. Thank you very much for joining us. I want to let you know that the recording of this event will be posted. There's also going to be a podcast that you can get on Apple and Stitcher and Spotify. So look for that. These events are free and open. That's part of our policy, but they do take resources. We'd be grateful if you wanted to talk with us about contributions. You can get in touch with us on the following addresses. Thank you very much for joining us. Take care and be well.